Hello, welcome to episode 66 of the Extra Sequential Podcast, coming to you out of Perth, Western Australia. My name's Mladen and I'm joined by Chris. How you going?
Good, mate. Yourself?
Not bad. And for those of you who are wondering what we're doing this week, we're going to be delving into the psychological terror of war.
I think you'll find that we won't be too serious.
Yeah, I think we'll do like what MASH does, which is swing wildly between comedy and then like, oh, the senseless terrors of war.
Well, there is a Hawkeye in Marvel Comics, so...
The chicken was a baby. So, yeah, we'll be talking about war comics later in the show. Following on, we'll also be doing a review of Frank Miller's new work. I didn't want to call it an opus.
It's not. It's the opposite of an opus, really.
A five-minute scribble, Holy Terror, yes. in the context of modern war. And I'm sure Chris will mention some violent video game he's been playing that I know nothing about.
That sounds like most conversations we have.
Yes, very good. Let's get into the news.
So it was our good friend, Neil Gaiman's birthday. He's not our good friend.
I was like, stretching it a bit.
Well, we're probably both friends with him on Facebook, but that doesn't mean anything. So he's 51 this week. So congratulations to the scribe of such works as... stuff that goths like to read. I don't know, Sandman.
I was like, you're going to struggle with this because he's never written for Green Arrow or whatever. So you're like, I don't know what comic he done.
Has he written superhero-wise? He's must have done some superhero.
He's written Batman stories.
He does. He had done Batman. That is true.
There you go. I'm sure he's written... No, he hasn't written a Wolverine story. I can't imagine what that would be like. Awesome, no doubt.
Stardust, the movie.
Yes.
Starring Robert De Niro as a pirate.
He did Coraline, which we both fans of, and we received cease and desist letters from just for even mentioning on this show.
Well, I don't think we got one of those.
No, we just got shut down. It was rude.
It was rude.
I know. Yeah, so people don't go see Coraline as revenge. If you notice, we seem a bit different today. It's because we're recording on a Saturday, and my brain's all like in Saturday mode.
Are you wearing your pajamas?
No, but I'm wearing shorts, and anyone who knows me knows that that's a very rare occurrence. I don't wear shorts.
I don't know if I've ever seen you in shorts.
You haven't.
Well, every time I came to your house, you always covered your legs. Are you ashamed of your lower limbs?
Is that a little bit. A little bit. I've got fat ham thighs. In other news here, if you happen to live in Victoria and you have money that's burning a hole in your pocket, you can get DC Vanity license plates.
Yes.
Now, these you can get with featuring The Flash, Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Green Lantern, Supergirl, which I don't know if anyone's going to get that one, but they're all the 70s classic designs by Joe Luis Garcia Lopez.
Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
And Dick Giordano. And they're going to be $195 each. So you've got to really like to have a little picture of Superman on the back of your license plate.
Yeah, I think just get a... sticker and put it on your windscreen. I don't know. I've never owned a car. You can get Looney Tunes ones as well.
Would you get one of these, Chris?
No, because I don't have a car. So what am I going to stick it to? The back of my pants?
With a couple of indicators on either side. In other news, Cinebook publisher and founder Olivier Cadic is decorated with the French National Order of Merit. So we both applaud him for that, and it's for his role in spreading French culture to the West. And to put it in perspective, his publisher Cinebook, which has been doing a great job publishing old versions of Lucky Luke, Is No Good, French comics of new and old, I suppose. But they published twice as many Lucky Luke comics in the last 3 years as have been published in the previous 50. So, I think that's wonderful, and mega congratulations to Olivier and Cinebook for that.
Yeah, I get their emails, and they do a lot of good stuff, actually. You don't read enough of their works, but it's good that that's open to people like us, or people like me, that only speak one language. Wouldn't find this stuff otherwise.
Keeping it French just for a minute, the new Asterix creative team has been confirmed. Jean-Yves Ferry, who's the scriptwriter for Retour à la Terre, that's my best guess, Back to Nature, that's in English, the translation, and Frédéric Mebaki, who's been the inker on Asterix, assistant inker for about 30 years, and he's also known for doing the illustrated merchandising material, which Durso's like, I'm not going to waste my good hand on that crap. But no, so yeah, the creative team's been confirmed, and we look forward to seeing what they can do. I'm pretty sure Durso's guiding them through their debut. See, they're called albums in France, so calling it a debut album makes it seem like they're recording a CD. But
oh, Asterix!
You know, in the 70s, I don't know if you ever watched any of the animated Asterix films, but they all have like funky little terrible theme songs done by pop bands of the period.
Oh, yes.
Yes. It's not too far from the reality. Do you have any other news items?
No, that's all. It's been pretty slow, really.
I've only had one more, and it's got to do with the Akira casting news. And I'm sure more will come to a head as we go. And we know that Garrett Hedlund's pretty much the forerunner to play Kaneda.
Yep, he's from Tron.
Yeah, so I'm guessing he either insists on riding a motorcycle in every film he's in, or he'll be doing a biopic of Marlon Brando, I guess, or a remake of The Wild One, whatever. And they're throwing up a few names right now for Tetsuo, and one of them, who's named Alden Ehrenreich, that's my best guess, he looks exactly like what Tetsuo looks like in the comics. Like, cool. Exactly like him, even though he's white.
Asian?
No, he's white, but he's got the exact same head shape. It's very unusual. People who've read the comic, have a look at this guy and tell me I'm wrong. And guess who else has been considered? Gary Oldman, Keira Knightley, Helena Bonham Carter. This should be an unusual film. I don't know if we'll see it.
But sounds like a Harry Potter movie.
It really does. Or the new Batman thing. I don't think they're taking any risks with the casting on this one, do you?
Yeah. No. I'm curious to see it. Because I guess a lot of... I mean, the animated film is quite old, so I guess a lot of people haven't seen it, so this would be opening it up to a whole new audience. But hopefully it'll bring it back and respect the original, hopefully.
I don't know how it's going to work thematically, but we'll talk about that on another show. Let's get into the topic. War is here. My brother's dead in Mars. In war here. It's here for you and me. Chris, war is...
What is it good for?
Yes, that's
why. Well, some pretty good comics, apparently.
So I've found. And the challenge with this is sort of limiting yourself to just picking, say, just a handful we want to talk about, you know? And I thought, because otherwise we'd be here talking all day about pulp adventure comics from the 40s, The Flying Ace and so forth. But what was your approach for thinking of comics for this topic?
Well, I thought in honor of... Modern Warfare 3 and Battlefield 3, which have both come out. It's also Remembrance Day, which is a lot more serious. But so I thought, well, war, I guess, is on people's minds, and war is a topic we haven't done, so we thought we could try and rein it in in more kind of... war actually has quite an intrinsic part. It's tied into a lot of the history of comics. It was kind of a genre that was pretty big. It's like the Western and the romance that was kind of big in the 30s to 50s to 60s and isn't around as much anymore.
Yeah.
But as I was kind of looking into the research, I was quite surprised how many DC war series there were. Not that far away, not that long ago either. But, so what we want to do was focus on more realistic war. So there's a lot of superhero wars. You've got Marvel Civil War and Secret War. DC's Worlds at War, Sinestro Corps War, various crises, Kingdom Come. You got G.I. Sure. Joe from Marvel and IDW. You got lots. But
you've got Future Wars. You got Star Wars and such. And we're trying to keep away from, say, there's a few kind of fictional ones here, but they're more like our reality, just a short step away. So not versus aliens. Nothing prehistoric. So we're not going to be talking about 300 here, for example.
No, good point.
Keeping it modern era, I suppose. And I don't know about the selections you made, but my picks are less the less the kind of adventure-y tone and more of a dramatic tone.
Mine are pretty adventure-y.
Okay. Well, that should be an interesting contrast that we can talk about then.
Your life with a lot more drama, but Zion, live my life with a lot more adventure.
You do get a kick out of murdering people, Chris. I've learnt that.
I carry a whip.
That's a slow and torturous death.
All right. Like Indiana Jones.
Could you have picked a more inconvenient way to murder someone? I've been here for hours. All right.
I'd just strangle them, wouldn't you? Rather than the whip.
Yeah, that would work. Strangle them with a ceiling fan. That works.
Is that in the James Bond movie?
That's in an Indiana Jones movie. How come Harrison Ford never played 007? Anyway, I thought we could open things off by talking about this new book from the master of schlock, Frank Miller.
Oh, yes.
that's the title I'm giving him now. But now Frank's sort of, over the last couple of decades, he's sort of cemented himself as a bit of a diminishing returns author.
Yes, Frank Miller is he's a legend in the field. I mean, what he's done for comics, especially on Daredevil, and then later you mentioned 300, but also Dark Knight Returns,
Year One.
Yeah, got the animated film of which has just come out, and I hopefully we'll be watching that shortly. But yeah, so you're right. Sin City, I guess, and 300 about his last great masterworks. Mm. And now we have Frank Miller's Holy Terror, the first kind of coffee table-ish book done in the landscape format with the hardcover from Legendary Comics, which is the first publishing offshoot of Legendary Pictures, who do 300, the Batman films and Superman films, do a lot of DC work. So this is written and drawn by Frank Miller. Most of you, if you're familiar with Maniac Miller, might have followed this story. It's been in the works since about 2006. It was originally solicited as announced as Batman Holy Terror, with an exclamation mark, I believe. Yes. And it was basically just going to be The Dark Knight versus Al-Qaeda. And that's what he was working on for a few pages.
Yeah.
Then basically DC changed his mind, or he changed his mind and he took Batman out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still see a lot of Batman in it. So
it basically follows, Batman and Catwoman under different names. And for all intents and purposes, they are those characters on these pages.
Yeah, we should put out there, I was actually, I think in 1991, there was an Elseworlds one-shot called Batman Holy Terror, which was a series where Batman kind of in the time of the Crusades and stuff. I think Norm Bray Fogel might have even drawn it. But this is nothing like this. So, yeah, you're right, the Batman and Catwoman influence and even the Commissioner Gordon influence can all be seen in these pages, and that's a shame. I mean, I wish he would have just either scrapped the project altogether or just convinced DC or himself that keeping it with Batman is a good idea, or maybe even just changing the baddies to general terrorists like in True Lies. So for all intents and purposes, for all of that, it doesn't really work, does it?
No, I mean, the problem with this book, I mean, a lot of the heat's kind of worn off, and I get the feeling reading through it, a lot of his kind of anger and so forth wore down as he was writing it. I mean, this has been a book for far too long in the making. I almost would have understood it better if he had created it in like a furious, like, single month and put it out like the week after, you know, an attack and said, this is what it is. I'm angry. I'm mad. I'm going to stay mad. Whereas this is more, it feels kind of forced. And we should quickly describe what happens. I mean, your superhero character who's called the Fixer here.
Yep, he's basically kind of like Batman, but in brown, and doesn't have ears on his cowl.
Yeah, and neither does the Catwoman character. Otherwise, they're both dressed similarly. Anyway, they're frolicking around on the rooftops, punching each other up in the typical Miller style, which is meant to be kind of sexy violence. And then regular violence turns its head, and then they're both shocked. And then they go on like a two-person killing spree. Just kind of shooting down these basically really dumb terrorist thugs, which has nothing to do with reality in any sense. So for me, it was really kind of boring in that sense. It was kind of an imaginary person fights an imaginary villain, and then they even go to an imaginary villain's lair, which I don't know if Frank Miller imagines that Al-Qaeda is run by this charming personality who lives in a palace or whatever. But there's no reality in it. It's very dull, and I find Miller's written interviews and opinions on the topic are far more truthful and interesting.
Yeah, he's not backwards and coming forward, as they say. He's pretty vocal, and you can kind of see the hate and the anger. And, you know, obviously, you know, as an American, I guess he's still got 9/11 and whatnot in the forefront of his mind. You can see this is kind of an artist trying to come to grips with that madness of terror that just doesn't make any sense. And he's kind of spewing it forth on the page. Mm. And obviously, as an artist, that's, of course, his right and his intent to do that. And I guess because he's so familiar with this kind of superhero comics and battles and daring adventures with larger-than-life heroes, he's just throwing in his political opinions into a kind of a loose superhero template. So I think that concept works, but I don't think this book, Holy Terror, works as such. I mean, you know, it's a 50-page book if you buy it in Australia, a $50 book. And it's mainly black and white. It's very sketchy. Most people, I would say, would not like this work. But it's interesting. The more I read it, as I started to flick through it, I could still see kind of charming demonstrations of his almost genius kind of boring. Like the stuff that he's doing with storytelling here, you won't find on the stands. I mean, it's very Sin City likes. If you like Sin City, you will like this. It's very, you know, a lot of silhouettes, but like kind of, you know,
nine very stark pages.
Not many backgrounds. A lot of splattering and texturing on pages.
Splash pages, like, frequently. I mean, before I used to kind of criticize him for that, but since he's kind of gone, look, this is my thing, he's made it on his own aesthetic out of just pages and pages of splash pages, and that's how they read.
Almost works better as almost like a portable gallery. You could just, rather than an actual story to be told.
Considering the dialogue, especially for most of the book, is just characters repeating the same thing.
It's very repetitive, isn't it? Keep saying the same thing. I thought, is he trying to make a song out of this or something?
Well, they kept saying, damn, terrorists. And then there'd be like two pages just of exposition, just talking heads. And it was very awkward. And there's a few other awkward things in here. I mean, a couple of pages where you think he's going to explore like an interesting idea, like he juxtaposes these two panels of these dim-witted like audience watching a screening of Transformers. And then there's a trio of, I guess, dim-witted Arabs. Stoning a woman somewhere in the Middle East. And that, I thought, okay, this is interesting. He's either like lamenting a lack of ideology in the West or criticizing our apathy when this sort of things is going on in some form. But then he kind of stops himself and goes back to the boring action movie violence stuff.
Yeah, and I think he does. When he does do it, like there's a pretty good scene in here when a terrorist take down the Statue of Liberty, and that's pretty interesting. Like it's pretty well choreographed. There's an interesting bit where the Catwoman character kind of puts in the burqa and covers her face as kind of invades the James Bond villain like
Doctor
Lair.
Doom's lair, as I imagined in this book,
with giant snails and. I guess it's that like some kind of weird dream sequence. I was trying to figure out what was going on here. But and then she basically just kicks all these guys. It's interesting because she gets their attention by flashing them a bit of her fishnet stockings because obviously they're not seeing women like that. And then she goes nuts in some pink pages, which obviously meant to show, you know, I'm a feminist, but I can still kick you in the teeth. So some of the pages look good, but it's just not enough. It almost would have worked good as like a 40-page annual or like a webcomic or something.
Just a single thing, just while he was mad, while he had the
iron. Yeah, a lavishly produced, 100-and-something-odd page, $50 expensive
book. You can see the point when the energy wears off, and it's I'm pretty sure we could both detect the point. It's after the first after the first attack. And all those opening pages are all right. But then it's as it wears down, I got kind of – he got into his usual violence is fun and sexy mode. Like it's like he's reveling in this kind of martyrdom, like he was just waiting for the chance to show this stuff. I don't know. It's very awkward and doesn't quite work in that sense. I just he would almost this book would have been great if he'd done it in a Dave Sim kind of way, like Glamourpuss, where – he just written it with his own voice and chose to illustrate certain things. Because he is an interesting person in interviews. I don't agree with everything he says, but he has, he has the right to make certain points, and he has the right to be angry for sure. And he's always made a stance against any kind of fundamentalist stuff, whether it's, he's taken shots at, fundamentalist Christians and Islamists and politics and what have you before. And I don't really think they deserve anything more than F off in comic book form, which I guess is what this is.
Yeah, it's interesting. He actually dedicates the book to a guy called Theo van Gogh, who I had to look up on Wiki. It's a Dutch filmmaker who was very vocal against kind of the Islamic fundamentalists as well. He was actually assassinated in 2004, as was one of his friends. So I guess you can see that's where he's coming from. But, it's a shame that Frank Miller can't do more. I don't want to use the word normal because I don't think we don't want to comics are a place for big ideas, so yes. We don't want to be seen as I think comics can fit politics and all sorts of things, but this as a piece, it just doesn't quite work. I think you need to spend more time with the story or perhaps work with another writer.
Mm. Or abandon the story altogether and done more of a, this is Frank Miller talking piece, yeah. You know, and I think he'd be fantastic at that kind of thing. I just, yeah, the conceit here with the superhero merging of this seems flippant and silly almost for me. So, yeah, not a success. I wouldn't recommend it.
No, but hopefully he keeps making comics because he won't be making movies anytime soon, I'd imagine, after the failure of The Spirit.
Well, I heard Sin City 2 was well underway in
pre-production. Yeah, I don't know if he's going to be directing that, though.
We'll find out. I'm sure they'll find a way to involve him. See, I thought he was writing the whole screenplay and all that stuff again. Should we keep it modern for a while and talk about some more kind of recent views of similar kind of, I guess, issues of terrorism and so forth?
Sure.
Yeah. Because, I mean, obviously comics like DMZ come to mind, and DMZ is pretty close to wrapping up now, and I should mention very briefly, DMZ is a Vertigo comic by Brian Wood and a series of revolving artists, and they sort of tackle the idea of what if the US kind of splinters along the faction lines of very right-wing, left-wing, and New York. It's a bit outlandish that New York would become the battleground for this, but the DMZ, the demilitarized zone between what's the free states and the US, is kind of this hotly contested area where most people are just trying to make their way in the world, and it becomes kind of this chest-beating battle between, you know, US forces and the separationists, I guess, and these people stuck in the middle and the journalist who covers it in between. And I mean, DMZ, when it's wrapped up, I'd like to maybe do a look back on it and then lend you all the books and we can talk about it in more detail.
Sure.
But it's interesting to see how it draws from real life journalistic accounts from modern wars. And I had a chance this week to read The Fixer, a story from Sarajevo by Joe Sacco. Are you familiar with his work at all?
Interesting. I know the name, but I haven't read any of it.
Yeah, he's done Safe Area, Garage There, and Tales from Palestine. It's a name like that. I haven't read those two yet. I'm having trouble getting hold of some of these for some reason. But he went to Slovenia and Palestine and kind of wrote comic book journalism. And it's actually very effective stuff. And I reading The Fixer this week, it's very kind of layered, textured work. You get a real sense of the place and its people. And it opens with these eerie scenes of the gutted Holiday Inn, which is only a few miles from the front. And so, yeah, he did this in 95. He meets Neven, who's basically his guide, and he's a former weapons specialist, sniper, gunrunner, hitman, soldier for hire, and half-Serbian-born Bosnian nationalist. And this is in 1995, so kind of at the peak of the conflict there in the Balkans. But I mean, he paints the picture of Yugoslavia and Bosnia there, and what you see of this melting pot where all these different factions arise, and there's no clear lines of sides, really. And because it's really interesting to see how he breaks it down, because there was no organized defense force at that particular time, which meant that the Bosnian Ministry of Defense and police incorporated all these paramilitary groups who are made up of criminals and sportsmen and guys who just decided to, you know, take advantage of the situation, and they into their military structure. And you can imagine what comes of that, where civilians are press ganged into digging trenches under gunfire. There's murdered civilians, a lot of real life stuff, but seeing it from that personal level is really quite affecting. And I mean, DMZ follows, kind of borrows that in a lot of sense, even though that's a fictional account. I can see where Brian Wood's taken these real life comic book accounts like Joe Sacco's and worked them into fiction. It's well worth reading this sort of stuff, and especially to get a sense of this modern history and modern conflicts, quite different to the days of World War One or World War Two, where the spread of information was difficult, so the government could really control your idea of who the enemy is, whereas this place, it's very, especially in Yugoslavia in the time where it was quite mixed, the borders had been open for the last, 30 years under socialism. And then, yeah. But, I'd absolutely recommend any of the Fixer or Safe Area Garage there. I mean, there's moments of humor. It's really well drawn, especially if you dig, kind of underground comics, and there's, gut-wrenching stories. And there's a great tale where one of them tells of this time him and his 14 men with 6 rocket grenades have held back a line of 43 tanks. And then later on, another character laughs and tells him, oh, that never happened. He's just pulling your chain. And that calls into question everything this guy's told the journalist before. And it's just interesting, the kind of journalistic approach to this subject matter.
Yeah, I guess the other one that kind of, when you're talking about that, would be Joe Kubert's Facts from Sarajevo, which is one I've heard of but never actually read. And I think he was corresponding with the guy who was trapped in the building during the battle. This is 1996, I think. And he was basically just getting faxes out, and Joe Kubert basically just turned it into a comic.
Cool.
And we'll talk about Joe Kubert later. He's done a lot of war comics.
Yeah, there's a couple I didn't get a chance to read, but I know he's done some Vietnam comics and so forth, and there's quite a few Vietnam comics. I know you wrote a few comics this week.
Speaking of Vietnam, Guerrillas, as in G-U-E.
Yeah.
Guerrillas. This is written and drawn by Bram Revell, which is a cool name. And it's interesting, the introduction is actually by Jason Publick, who's one of the creators of the Venture Brothers cartoon.
Mm. Right.
I haven't really seen it, but I'm familiar with it or aware of it. And it was meant to be the first book in a trilogy, but now... after Jackson Publick saw this, he basically hired Bram Revell to work on the Venture Brothers show with him. So he said, I'm sorry about that, comics. I don't know when the other two books are going to come out now because he's mine. But basically it's a sentence on this new recruit in the Vietnam War, Private John Francis Clayton. And he's been in the his first tour in there for the first few days, and he's obviously just a kid straight out of high school pretty much. He's just overwhelmed. He joins this platoon of other much more manly, tough guys than him who all kind of get lost or start dying one by one. Well, most of them. But it's pretty intense. I mean, basically, you'll see on the cover, it's a gorilla, well, it's a chimp rather, with an ape with a M16 smoking. So I thought, this will probably be a relatively fun comic. Chimps as was I wrong. So this is from Oni Press, black and white, now a little kind of digest form. I think it was originally 3 issues, and this collects them all in this single digest format. But it's pretty intense, Maladin. It's pretty full-on. I mean, you've got the soldiers, cutting ears off and raping villagers and, I mean, not all in gory, intense detail, but I was like, oh, okay, this isn't going to be a fun or funny comic. But it kind of drops you in the midst of that straight away, so you really get an idea of this of Private John. He's just overwhelmed and just freaking out. He hardly speaks at all, so you just feel sorry for the poor kid. And then eventually, obviously, he finds these chimps that have been kind of trained as a science by this German scientist to be like the perfect soldiers, and they've escaped. So they basically rescue him, and he kind of hangs around with them for the rest of the book. As I said, it's not funny, but it's very interesting. I read it all in one read.
Do you think they're making a point about modern soldiers there, or what's the analogy mean to you?
Hairy knuckles. Well, it doesn't go into that pretty much. It's mainly just an adventure.
But you make that choice for a reason as a writer. I'm just curious what whether there's any subtext.
Well, I mean, the thing is, that the scientist is basically just trying to make these chimps expendable more so than humans, but they get a bit carried away and get let loose, so he has to set the other chimp after them, and John's original platoon to go and hunt these crazy apes, crazy chimps down. I keep saying apes and chimps and gorillas. I don't know what they are. Monkeys have tails, don't they?
Yes.
These don't have tails. But essentially, all of the hairy beasts have personalities. Yeah. They don't talk, but there is a pretty good scene where John kind of hallucinates that they're all talking. They're all addicted to smokes, and he's pretty freaked out by them all because they don't talk to him, but they kind of just accept him as one of their own. And it's funny, like he's just walking along with them in the forest, and they all get excited when they find these big termite mounds, and so they stick, sticks down to get these termites, and they offer him some. And it's got little moments of kind of humour like that. Mm. Like there's a bit where John has this Polaroid of a girl in his helmet.
Yeah.
And one of the other guys in his squadron kind of takes it off and goes, I'll be keeping that, thanks. And then the leader, the boss, is, you know, give it back to him. And then we find out that it's actually not his girlfriend, but it's just something that he cut out from this girl he had a crush on at high school. He just cut it out of the yearbook. And then he has like a fantasy about her later and starts to touch myself. But yeah, it's actually a pretty good book. So it's called Gorillas. It's out now for from Omi Press, volume one. Hopefully in the next two volumes come out. Because it's more than just a novelty story. Like, it's more than kind of just, hey, look at this. It's chimps with guns, hijinks and shoes. It's actually a pretty serious kind of comic. And I'm curious to see more. The art is pretty kind of sketchy, not extremely detailed and not in your face, but he does the kind of jungle scenes and the personalities and the faces of every soldier really well. So it's not one for kids. Despite what the cover may have you thinking, well, the cover's got a smoking chimp on it, so I suppose that wouldn't appeal to kids anyway. But, yeah, I'd like to read more of this. So hopefully I don't know if the Venture Brothers cartoon ever finishes, he can get right back on that. But there was a nice – because there's been a fair few Vietnam War comics, so this was nice for something a little bit different.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, looking at a lot of mine, you do see Vietnam was kind of a turning point for war in the West, I suppose, war fiction, and even in like say film of like 50s and 40s war films, they weren't bloodless, but they were had a kind of a very
nobility.
That's definitely a good term for it. They definitely sold the idea of ideology and so forth. And I guess post Vietnam, and you see it in the comics actually as well. It's a shift to the effect it has on people and like the personal costs of it and the ridiculousness of this kind of conflict, and the adventure aspect was played down. And I guess in the last couple of years, the adventure aspect's been played back up just a little bit. I've noticed it, say in video games and so forth. Maybe that's left over from the, say the late 80s, because it was still kind of tortured war, but I guess you could get Nintendo video games with war taking place and so forth.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of World War II games and stuff over the last few years, and I guess because we're a generation that hasn't had a war, so perhaps we're removed from the reality of that.
We've had one for the last 10 years. It's just not been on our TV screens.
Well, not one that we've been, you know, conscripted to or whatever.
Yeah, lucky us, right? But genuinely lucky us. But the Vietnam War was the first kind of majorly documented war in history. Up till that point, newspapers could present like a limited view. But I think that was the first war where they had televised coverage, you know, kind of live almost of what was happening over there. And that was kind of the point when – and before then as well, but it was kind of the point where people could really see what it was actually like. Not so much the John Wayne and his blazing – combat troop, you know, that kind of junk. And Blazing Combat, which is a comic from Warren Publishing in 1960.
That is Vampirella,
I think. Yeah, I know, right? It's interesting putting these Blazing Combat comics in context of, you know, Eerie and Creepy and Vampirella, which were all their books as well. But it only lasted 4 issues, after which the distributors refused to have it, and I'll get into that in a sec. But it was kind of a compilation comic, sort of short, done-in-one stories, like 8-page stories, and you had the likes of Gene Colan, Frank Frazetta, John Severin, Alex Toth and Wally Wood, and Archie Goodwin wrote almost all of the stories, so there's like a unified tone to them.
Yep.
And that had a blend of like contemporary and period war stories, and they all focused on war kind of in the negative, in that it was, you know, the personal cost to the people. Most often they were set in World War II, but the viewpoint was very modern in that it was considered unpatriotic at the time, this comic, to show that anyone wasn't totally wrapped up in let's get them, fellas, attitude.
Yeah.
There's a story in there called Landscape, which is set in Vietnam War, and it follows this rice farmer whose family and land is repeatedly devastated in every successive war in the region, to the point where to him there's just literally no difference between the Viet Minh, the Viet Cong, the American troops, what have you. He just does not see a difference, and they're all just troops to him, and he just wants to go on living. So it's like this negative light on this thing, and apparently that one in particular was a major reason the distributors all got together and decided to stop shipping it. And apparently war comics at the time were bought up a lot by actually to be supplied to stationed soldiers overseas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Something you can still do to this day, by the way.
Really?
Yeah. And a lot of GIs kind of took comics and kind of spread the influence of American comics to other nations that wouldn't, and kind of left the influence behind. And obviously a lot of creators coming back from the war were in the war themselves, so I guess they brought those sensibilities. But yeah, comics and war, especially World War II, kind of intermingled in their history. They kind of grew up together, I guess you could say.
Oh, definitely. And they play off each other, and I guess, yeah, now that we've got back into this phase where it's this war's a business now, strangely enough, you know, and the attitude's slightly different to it now. So I'm curious to see how it changes over the next 20 years to see if, not just the conflicts, but how the fiction reflects that. Another Vietnam book I'll mention here is The Other Side.
Yes.
This one you may remember in passing. It was kind of the first work that got Jason Aaron a fair bit of attention. He'd entered some competition through Marvel, hadn't he, to write a Wolverine comic.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, and after that, this was like his first full-length work, first major work, and it was Eisner-nominated. It's a five-issue mini, I think from 2005, but I'd need to check that. Set in 68 during the peak of the American involvement in Vietnam, and it kind of tells these thematically parallel stories of this young Viet Cong, Vo Binh Dai, and a young Alabama troop, Bill Everett, and it kind of contrasts their backgrounds because one joins from patriotism and the other's conscripted, and I'll leave it up to people who read them to know which one's which, but they both begin to lose their sanity, and you kind of follow them through their training, like the torturous, on foot journeys through jungle and swamp while under fire, and then briefly the battles. And Everett begins to see like the zombie-like ghosts of his dead comrades, who are kind of comical almost because they're all just sort of watching him and just not really saying anything. They're not even reaching for him per se. They're just kind of watching him like, yep, you're next. So he's kind of losing it. But it's a psychological horror story with surreal elements, and it's like utterly serious, but there's a lot of dark humor throughout. I think it's pretty well balanced, especially with both characters and seeing the detail that's gone into it. I know Cameron Stewart, the artist on it, traveled to Vietnam and did a fair bit of research there to get ready for the book. And I know Jason was actually inspired by his cousin, who was actually the writer of Full Metal Jacket, believe it or not.
Wow, cool. Yeah.
And this was interesting for me. The Other Side was also the first Vietnam War book published by DC since 1967. There'd not been anything they'd done since that, you know, in what, the 30-odd years on that topic. I find that fascinating.
Well, I'll get to that because I think, yeah, well, perhaps the first original, because there were DC comics right even up until the 80s. But, yeah, I think The Other Side was perhaps the first original one. A lot of those ones were kind of throwbacks from the 60s. They've been going for a couple of decades.
Were they set in Vietnam or were they set in World War II?
Oh, sorry, they were set in World War II.
Yeah, because they just wouldn't touch the one risky war. I'm sure they had war comics all throughout that point, just not that one. Didn't want to rock the boat, yes. I guess. I'm wondering if the Comics Code Authority had some say in that also, because I'm sure they would go to some lengths to ban anything that could be seen as commenting on current political issues. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Possible. All right, let's go back in time.
Sure.
Enemy Ace. Are you familiar with Enemy Ace?
No.
You're about to be. Strap yourself in. Created by Robert Kaniger, who did a lot of DC's war comics for about 20 years almost, and Joe Kubert, who I mentioned before, in 1965, basically Enemy Ace is a kind of based on the Red Baron. So he's like a German fighter pilot, Hans von Hammer, and he has a red Fokker triplane. Mm-hmm. Set in World War One. Garth Ennis actually, it's interesting because DC had a lot of history for war comics that seemed to be long-running, and then there was something in the air in like the last 10 or so years where Vertigo or mainstream writers kind of revisited these concepts. So Garth Ennis actually did a Enemy Ace, War in Heaven miniseries in 2001. Mm-hmm. But I've got the DC Showcase Presents, and if you're after cheap, old-timey comics, the Showcase Presents series are basically kind of like the Marvel Essentials in that they reprint in black and white a whole bunch of different series, so it's very cheap to get. So for like 20, 30 bucks, I mean, it's like 552 pages of comics, all in black and white, and this collects every Enemy Ace story done for the time being anyway. So it's set in World War One. Originally they were backup stories, but it's interesting because so it's got like you read four pages and then it says part one, carried, you know, but it, they're not disjointed. So these would have been over a few of their different, like our world at war, sorry, our army at war or GI combat or whatever. These series would have been backup tales, but collected here, you don't get that disjointed feeling. So this collects every Hans-von Hammer story between 1965, his debut, and 1982. Nicknamed the Hammer of Hell, he's a bit of a loner. He's kind of his men and kind of fear and respect him. They call him the human fighting machine. But it's interesting, he's kind of like Captain Kirk. So every time he goes into up into the air with anyone of his supporting cast, they're kind of like the red shirts on Star Trek, like they just go up and die. So he always comes back alone. But it's all told in his narration, which is very kind of serious and talks about the dangers and stupidity of war. And then he talks a lot about how him and his machine are as one. He gets close enough to the enemy planes that he can count the stitches on their canvas body, stuff like that. Like here's a quote to write down. The sky has turned into a deadly circus of somersaulting planes, like maddened acrobats hurling flaming confetti. So it's kind of got this poetic narration just kind of weaving through it. It talks a lot about that the skies are unforgiving and pilots only make one mistake, their last. So he's for a German pilot, it's a pretty interesting character to choose as the hero of an American comic, but he's never. I mean, he doesn't really talk about you know the politics and that kind of side of things.
And air combat's quite kind of distant, isn't it? And I mean, he can choose to not show anyone within the other plane if he chooses to not. It's kind of like it's almost like a video game, isn't it? Taking down non-human opponents.
That's true. And I guess World War One is an interesting period. We talked about the nobility and the kind of valor of war, and there's a lot of that in here. I mean, I guess obviously if it was set in, say, World War Two, I don't think the pilot would be German necessarily. But he's a bit of a loner. He doesn't really enjoy killing anyone, but he acknowledges that he's basically just really good at it. He's got the most kills than everybody, and every time he makes an extra kill, he gets given a trophy, and the people keep saying they're running out of room. So he basically just hangs out with himself, and then he goes to the Black Forest, and he meets this nameless wolf, and he kind of talks to this wolf, even though the wolf obviously doesn't talk back, but he kind of senses this kindred spirit in him. There's one where he gets crushed.
It's like a Kevin Costner movie come to life.
Shot down, and he falls on the edge of the Black Forest, and this wolf kind of protects him from the other wolf pack that wants to eat him. So it's a fairly realistic comic. Like you could tell that Robert Kaniger, the writer of I think all of these stories, has done his research. Like he obviously knows his planes well. If you're a historian in World War One, you can obviously read through these with a fair bit of interesting stuff. There's even like little they've reprinted like the posters or the battle albums, that as they call them, which talk about the different the blueprints of the different planes and that he and the weapons. So it's very kind of technically precise, I'd imagine. But even though there's a realism, there's like he needs good guys to fight, and there's a couple of baddies that from different countries that show up here and there. There's one called the Hangman. He basically is just a pilot who wears kind of like, well, the Hangman costume. There's a Canadian ace, the Hunter. There's this Wild West American pilot called Balloon Buster.
Don't tell me he dresses like a cowboy in the plane.
He does.
Oh, no.
There's a Englishman.
Like the Mighty Ducks.
There's an Englishman in a suit of armour in a plane called St. George, and he says, you know, I'm going to destroy the enemies of England. You know, I'm going to slay the dragon. And so occasionally goes into kind of camp territory like that. But it's pretty dangerous, like all this sky combat, because these planes are made of canvas and wood, you know. So it's pretty interesting. But yeah, he sells the tactics really well. Like whenever there's kind of dogfights in the air, he does that really well. And as we said, there's the honor of combat. So when he captures the Wild West guy, Balloon Buster, they have dinner together. So I've captured you. Now let's have dinner before we put you aside in jail. And then obviously he escapes. There's an interesting story in here where enemy ace crashes in France in enemy territory, but because he knows French, he pretends to be a Frenchman. So he's walking wounded throughout the villages of France and hiding out. And he meets three different people on his journey as he makes his way back to his own airbase, and they all share with him, oh, you're a pilot too? Yeah, my son or my brother, or in my case, my fiance is all a pilot. And he's telling these people that he's the people that he meets, he's telling Hansman Hammer about these pilots, and he's in his mind knows that he's killed them all. So, but he obviously chooses not to say anything. But yeah, I actually enjoy it. There's a lot more than I thought they would. I mean, I don't like war comics, and I haven't read all of his stories. I mean, there's one in here where I think there's even a Batman team up for some reason. Oh. but yeah, the Joe Kubert does most of the art. So he's got that kind of wonderful, scratchy, kind of rough-hewn style that fits so well in the war comics. Mm. And then Neil Adams, I think, does a couple of comics in here as well. But yeah, it's actually, I enjoyed it much more than I thought I would. So yeah, that's DC Showcase Presents Enemy Ace, an unusual hero, but.
Yeah, I mean, the pilots of World War One were, historically, they were almost like war rock stars, because they were usually the ones who were promoted a lot in. Kind of
propaganda stuff. Yeah,
propaganda stuff. And also, I mean, even to the point, I don't know, do you remember an old Blackadder episode where they meet this pilot and and I'm pretty sure
it's one of the young ones, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. that's something you should revisit if you're in the mood for the topic. But yeah, they were kind of, I guess, because they were so separate from the war, you can play up the romanticism a lot. Really, it's like, it's almost like dueling, like a gentleman's duel in a way. And I mean, that's how they're presented. I'm not saying in reality that it was probably anything like that, but, I'd be interested to see if there are many, modern day pilot comics like that. Top Gun, the comic. I think I've seen, isn't there one where dinosaurs are riding in jet planes?
Dinosaurs and jet planes. No, I think you must have dreamt that after too much pizza or something.
It could be a Calvin and Hobbes comic I'm thinking of.
Spaceman Spiff.
Yeah. All right. Only a couple of others I'll just quickly mention in passing. I've mentioned Apocalypse Meow before, and that's this kind of surreal Japanese manga, which is drawn quite realistically. It's set during Vietnam, and for some reason the artist switches out all the human characters for adorable bunny rabbits. So while the story is done realistically, when they get brutally shot and, you know, maimed or whatever, it's for some reason it's a little bit more disturbing to see. So it's this strange artist decision there, and that's worth checking out. But it's not as comical as you might think from the name. It's presented very, very straight, as in, this is the only absurd thing about this comic is that they're cute, adorable animals. Everything else is done as realistically as possible, you know, with the detail to the research and so forth. A lot of European comics focused on kind of the messy politics of Cold War Europe. I know Slovenian Tomas Slavic returns to it really frequently. As does Enki Bilal, and it's not so much war, but it does focus on politics. Enki Bilal I'm pretty sure the Black Order Brigade and Hunting Party have been collected fairly recently by humanoids, so that's something you can pick up and is worth checking out for that kind of content, but less so much the adventurous war stuff. That's come back in a big way, as we've seen with some of I'm sure you read a few others.
I did. Well, the others I did want to mention, I mentioned at the start that DC kind of had this long history of war titles, and I was kind of surprised how long they ran for. So Enemy Ace is obviously one. I mean, that ran as a backup series for, what I say, 20 years almost. And pretty much all of them were created by Robert Kaniga, the writer, and Joe Kubert, the artist. So another one, which most of these were kind of anthology series. So you had Our Army at War, which ran from 52 to 77, and that featured Enemy Ace and also Sergeant Rock. He's one of DC's, I guess, most, and we'd be foolish not to mention him. He's kind of, I guess, DC's equivalent of Nick Fury, but he doesn't consist in the modern day. GI Combat ran from 52 to 1987. That featured the Haunted Tank, which is a 19th century ghost who aided this guy called Jeb Stuart and his Sherman tank crew in World War II, and that also came back in 2008 as a Vertigo miniseries with the same ghost but with an African-American tank commander. Oh, so there was a bit of
was it a racist tank
going on there? yeah so it's like this kind of gentleman Civil War ghost. He was like, what, an African-American as a tank commander? So I think that was a 2008 Vertigo miniseries. Unknown Soldiers, another one, a long-running series that Vertigo again revisited recently. basically kind of like Darkman in a war, I guess, in World War II, I think most of them were set up, started again as a Sergeant Rock backup in our Army at War, and then Star Spangled Comics until 1982. She's ran for quite a few years. And then 1997, Garth Ennis did a miniseries. More recently, Joshua Dysart wrote 25 issues of The Unknown Soldier, kind of relaunch, a different character, yeah, set in modern times, 25 issues, and apparently it came to a proper conclusion. And I haven't read any of those, but that's meant to quite an interesting take. So it's good that DC kind of acknowledged that their rich history. Have you read any of those Vertigo kind of takes on Haunted Tank or Unknown Soldier?
No, I've kind of almost kept away from a lot of these. I don't know if that's to my loss. I've not read Army at Love either. That's one.
Oh, yes, that's another one. Yeah, more of a kind of parody, wasn't it?
Yeah, I believe that was set in like a fictionalized Iraq, Shmirak. You know, I think it was almost like a bad pun on
Jura.
Yeah, it was something like that.
Make it fictionalized nations.
And I think the concept in that was, it was almost like this big, like almost like a relationship drama, like not Dawson's Creek, but kind of Melrose Place on the front line with journalists.
Yeah, it's pretty sexy and embedding stuff. Embedding themselves. First issue, and yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know how long that lasted. I believe that only went for like 5 issues or something.
Yeah, I don't think it lasted that long. Marvel have a kind of, they don't have as long as a history of war comics for DC, do you? But a few I remember. The Nam, again based in Vietnam, that one ran for quite a while, I remember, written by Doug Murray, edited by Larry Hammer, who basically essentially created G.I. Joe for Marvel. Right, and I think he's been doing a lot of G.I. Joe work on and off the last few years. Semper Fi, I remember, when I was a kid, from 1988-99. It only ran for 9 issues, but it was based on Tales of the Marine Corps. And Sergeant Rock and his Howling Commandos.
Mm.
It ran from 1963-1981. Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created, Sergeant Fury and his, I'm getting my Rock and my Fury mixed up. Nick Fury, we know, is played by Samuel L. Jackson in the movies, but when he originally debuted, he was a white guy, and he still is in the kind of modern mainstream Marvel universe, but in the Ultimates universe, he's the black trench-coated, eye-patched, cigar-chomping, grey-haired kind of guy. So he was the director of S.H.I.E.L.D. And it's interesting, I was in the first issue of Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos, Stan Lee had to tell the printers that indeed Gabe Jones, who was one of the soldiers, was actually a black man because they coloured him as white because the interracial squads didn't actually exist in World War II. So kind of ahead of his time, old Stan Lee.
He was all for that, wasn't he? I know.
What's that?
He was all for that. Kind of just even to rewrite history in that sense to set, because really these are kind of their intent isn't as historical documents, they're adventure comics. And so the point was, look, you know, you're welcome in the Marvel playpen anytime.
Yeah, that's right. Isn't that nice? I mean, yeah, he's got, you know, mutants and disabled lawyers posing as superheroes. So,
mutants.
They had Commando comics, I guess. We'd be remiss not to mention Commando comics from England. You might have seen those in the newsagents and whatever, black and white digests focused on mainly World War One and World War Two. And they've been going for 50 years, and I believe the last few years most of the tales are reprints, but then they still keep publishing the odd news story. So I'm sure everybody's read a Commando comic at some point in their life, or had it in a show bag, or picked it up at a 50 cents at a bookstore or something.
Yeah, I hope that gives you a little bit of a reading list for sort of modern war comics. Yeah, hopefully there's something in there you'll enjoy.
And, yeah, if we missed anything, please shoot us an email, chris at extrasequential.com, or mention it on our Facebook page. Drop by, won't you please?
Thanks for joining us for another week. We'll be carrying on next week, as always, and you can get future shows from the Extra Sequential website as well as iTunes. Friend us on Facebook, as Chris mentioned. You can catch more of Chris's writing at Comic Book Jesus as well as Broken Frontier. Do you have anything interesting coming up there?
I'm going to be looking at the Lone Ranger, latest volume of the Lone Ranger series. Cool. And I've got there's always something. It's always something, Melvin.
You're very busy. I've noticed that.
I am. I'm trying to be less so. But what are you? How's the spin and the records going?
Pretty good.
You've just released your first actual physical EP, I believe.
It's a physical thing in my hands. It's something I can pass down to the Grand Chinnies.
And where can we purchase this item?
Why, sir, you can go to purgeaudits.com and order it online. Or if you're in Perth, you can head over to Fat Shan Records, grab one there. Or just nag me if I'm DJing and buy one off me. I'm sure I'll have one in my pocket somewhere. Otherwise, you can catch my writing at thefindmag.com, which will be music reviews.
Nice.
Yes. Next week, we'll surprise you with another topic. We'll surprise even ourselves.
We will.
All right.
You might even wear shorts.
Maybe I'll change it. I don't feel too good. My legs feel cold. All right. Thanks for joining us for another week, and you'll hear us talking at you next week. See you, Chris.
Bye, everyone. See you, Blaine.